This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, welcome to Cincinnati Association for the Blind Radio Reading Service. This is David Ness, and for the next 1 hour, we will be reading the front section of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal, which is Tuesday, September 9, and here is the first article, which is entitled, Justices Lift Curbs on L.A. Migrant Sweeps, Trump Crackdown That Earlier Targeted Largely Latino Areas Allowed to Proceed, Dateline Washington. The U.S. Supreme Court on Monday loosened restrictions on immigration raids in Los Angeles that a judge put in place after finding that federal authorities were likely using illegal racially profiling tactics. The court, in a brief unsigned order, granted an emergency request by the Trump administration to remove the limits while litigation continues. Government lawyers had argued that lower court had improperly interfered with agents' ability to conduct immigration enforcement in a high-priority metropolitan area that harbors a large population of immigrants who are in the U.S. without permission. The majority did not provide its rationale, as is typical in emergency orders, but Justice Brett Kavanaugh wrote a concurrence to explain his view that the administration had made strong arguments. He wrote that it was common sense and consistent with court precedent for federal officers to conduct immigration checks in parts of Los Angeles where violations were most likely, such as where day laborers gather looking for work. If the person is a U.S. citizen or otherwise lawfully in the United States, that individual will be free to go after the brief encounter, Kavanaugh wrote. The court's three liberal justices dissented. We should not have to live in a country where the government can seize anyone who looks Latino, speaks Spanish, and appears to work a low-wage job, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote, joined by Justices Elena Kagan and Ketanji Brown Jackson. The case is one of several prompted by the Trump administration's crackdown in Los Angeles. In a separate lawsuit, California Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, challenged President Trump's federalization of the California National Guard units to assist in the immigration operations. Last week, a federal judge in San Francisco found that some soldiers had engaged in civilian law enforcement operations, such as traffic control, violating the 19th century Posse Comitatus Act, which limits the domestic use of U.S. military forces. That decision, which forbids future violations, is on hold while the administration appeals. Monday's case has put a focus on the administration's strategies to increase immigration sweeps and deportations. The plaintiffs include immigrant rights organizations and Latino individuals who said they were stopped because of their appearance during federal patrols that descended upon car washes, bus stops, parking lots, and other places with a large Latino presence. On social media, Attorney General Pam Bondi noted the administration's winning record before the justices, who have green-lighted a range of Trump policies, including mass layoffs of federal employees, termination of education and research grants, and removal of Senate-confirmed independent commissioners before their terms end. Another massive victory at the Supreme Court, Bondi wrote, adding that immigration and customs enforcement agents can continue carrying out roving patrols in California. Attorneys for the plaintiffs said they would continue to pursue litigation. The high court order allows agents to target individuals because of their race, how they speak, the jobs they work, or just being at a bus stop or the car wash when ICE agents decide to raid a place, said Cecilia Wang, National Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, which represents the plaintiffs. For anyone perceived as Latino by an ICE agent, this means living in a fearful papers please regime. The Trump administration targeted the Los Angeles area in June for its mass deportation campaign, with ICE agents focusing on heavily Latino communities and places where day laborers congregate. Several individuals and groups affected by the raids filed suit alleging federal agents were violating constitutional guardrails, including the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable search and seizure. In July, a federal judge in Los Angeles ordered ICE to cease stopping people without reasonable suspicion they had violated immigration law, the normal standard under the constitutional protection. U.S. District Judge Maimi Ewusi Mensah-Frimpong, a Biden appointee, said agents could not rely solely on an individual's race or ethnicity, use of the Spanish language or accented English, presence at particular locations, or the type of work the person does. Last month, a federal appeals court in San Francisco rejected the government's appeal, prompting U.S. Solicitor General John Sauer to seek the emergency order. Sauer said in papers submitted to the Supreme Court that it makes sense for federal agents to consider these types of factors, given that many unauthorized immigrants speak Spanish and work as day laborers or in jobs such as landscaping and construction. No one thinks that speaking Spanish or working in construction always creates reasonable suspicion. Nor does anyone suggest those are the only factors federal agents ever consider, Sauer wrote. But in many situations, such factors alone or in combination can heighten the likelihood that someone is unlawfully present in the United States, he wrote. Hyundai raid bears shortage of technical skills in the U.S. Arrests in Georgia point to difficulty getting visas for needed personnel. The Trump administration wants tougher immigration enforcement. It also wants Asian manufacturing powerhouses to pour investment into U.S. factories. These goals are now clashing because Asian companies are having trouble getting enough work visas for personnel needed to get the U.S. plants running, immigration specialists said. Last week, the contradiction was highlighted when the U.S. carried out an immigration raid in Georgia and arrested some 300 South Koreans helping to build a Hyundai Motor joint venture battery plant. Now the South Koreans are expected to head home soon under a diplomatic deal, and experts said it might take longer and cost more for Asian companies to build their U.S. factories without the specialists they need. President Trump hinted at such concerns when he wrote on social media that his administration will make it quickly and legally possible for foreign investors to legally bring your very smart people with great technical talent to build world-class products. One cause of the issue is the U.S. shortage of skilled technical workers, which stems from a long-term decline in manufacturing employment and the offshoring of production. The U.S. lacks the workforce needed to support advanced industries such as semiconductors and biotechnology, according to a July report by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a Washington think tank. In semiconductors alone, an estimated 67,000 technical jobs are at risk of remaining unfilled by 2030 unless the workforce pipeline is expanded, according to the Semiconductor Industry Association. Asian companies, mostly from South Korea, Japan, and Taiwan, are investing hundreds of billions of dollars in U.S. manufacturing at the urging of both the Biden and Trump administrations. The detention of South Korean workers at the Hyundai Motor plant site in Georgia unfolded as Seoul and Washington completed a trade deal in which South Korea agreed to make $350 billion in U.S. investments. In exchange, the U.S. said most South Korean exports to the U.S., including cars, would be subject to a 15% tariff instead of an earlier proposed rate of 25%. Companies said they are willing to hire and train a U.S. workforce but cannot meet tight deadlines to get their plants running with U.S. workers alone. That is why it is common for hundreds of employees from the home country to descend on big project sites. Companies such as Hyundai and its battery-making partner LG Energy Solution often bring along the same contractors they work with at home. Around 250 of the roughly 300 South Koreans arrested work for contractors, LG Energy said. The detainees largely held temporary visas suitable for short-term training and supervising purposes, such as the B-1 visa, and many were working at the site as instructors, according to South Korean officials. Some had arrived in the U.S. through a visa waiver program that allows entry for up to 60 days for travel and certain limited business activities, they said. Don Southerton, a consultant who has advised South Korean companies, including Hyundai and operating in the U.S., said some Korean companies and their contractors in the past used visa waiver programs for short-term travel or business visits without triggering scrutiny. I don't think they ever had to worry about it, he said, and there has been so much encouragement for these plants to be in the U.S., he said. U.S. authorities said those arrested either crossed the border illegally, entered through a visa waiver program that prohibited them from working, or overstayed their visas. Hyundai said it was reviewing its processes to ensure its partners maintain the high standards of legal compliance that we demand of ourselves. Other types of employment visas for non-immigrants allow companies to bring in workers for longer periods, but they're not easy to get. The H-1B visa lets companies operating in the U.S. hire foreign workers in specialty jobs such as tech and engineering. The annual cap recently has been under 100,000 visas. The E-2 visa is designed for specialized workers at U.S. units of companies from regions with commerce treaties with the U.S., a category that includes Taiwan, South Korea, and Japan. Approval standards have been getting tougher as applications surge in South Korea, whose companies are overseeing many large projects in the U.S., said Hong Chang-wan, a lawyer at Seoul-based firm Cookman Immigration, who specializes in U.S. immigration matters. The U.S. might say such workers can be hired locally, but Korean firms say such talent is difficult to find and deploy quickly in a plant that you're trying to get going on schedule, he said. In 2023, Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing sought to bring in some 500 experienced workers to accelerate construction, igniting a protest by Arizona's construction unions. TSMC said the workers were there only for short-term support with no impact on local hiring. South Korea's trade and industry minister said last year that visa challenges have made it hard for many South Korean conglomerates to dispatch workers to the U.S. and increase investments there. In July, Representative Yong Kim, Republican of California, and others introduced a bill that would allot 15,000 visas for South Koreans with specialized education or expertise. The bill, proposed in varying versions over the past decade, has not moved forward. Similar visa categories have been created for countries such as Australia and Singapore through free trade agreements. The U.S. grants more than 10,000 E3 visas annually to Australian nationals in specialized fields, enabling them to work for up to 2 years in the U.S., renewable indefinitely. Wendy Cutler, a former U.S. trade negotiator who is now at the Asia Society Policy Institute, said South Korea pushed hard for special visas like those granted to Australia and Singapore when it negotiated its own free trade deal with the U.S., which took effect in 2012. Seoul ultimately did not get them, although it did win inclusion in the visa waiver program. With investment a U.S. priority, a longer-term solution is urgently needed, Cutler said. Next article, oil executives' big bet on Trump is paying off. Administration opens land to drilling and moves to roll back environmental restrictions and hobble renewable energy. Oil billionaire Howard Hamm high-fived Donald Trump on election night as results trickled in at the Mar-a-Lago watch party. Hamm, founder of family-owned oil and gas company Continental Resources, had good reason to celebrate. He and other oil men had donated tens of millions of dollars to help re-elect Trump, betting that his pro-fossil fuel agenda would stave off a long-term shift away from fossil fuels and keep the country hooked on gasoline. The wager is paying off. The Trump administration is opening swaths of wilderness land and federal waters to drilling, approving new terminals to export natural gas, and proposing to axe environmental regulations, including an Obama-era rule used to curb emissions from power plants, tailpipes, and oil and gas production. His One Big Beautiful Bill is expected to hobble renewable energy projects and stunt the adoption of electric vehicles. Oil executives now enjoy extraordinary access to the White House. Trump has taken to phoning oil bosses whose TV appearances he enjoys, such as Chevron CEO Mike Wirth, according to White House and industry officials. No doubt this administration understands how important energy is, said Toby Rice, CEO of natural gas producer EQT. Rice and ExxonMobil CEO Darren Woods sat at Trump's table during a July energy summit in Pittsburgh. So far, however, the industry's policy wins have not flowed through the company's bottom lines. Trump's shifting positions on trade, coupled with an increase in crude supplies globally, have depressed oil prices, cost energy firms billions of dollars in stock market value, and contributed to layoffs across the industry. And new tariffs on steel and aluminum are making drilling more expensive. U.S. oil prices are hovering near $62 a barrel, below the break-even point for many of the industry's smaller players, down from about $76 the week Trump took office. Yet some oil bosses see the turbulence as a price worth paying to see the president implement their agenda. White House spokeswoman Carolyn Leavitt said the oil and gas industry is the backbone of the American economy and the source of millions of good-paying jobs, and that the president is delivering on his promise to make America energy dominant again. Trump's unabashed support for the industry has left environmentalists aghast. They contend the administration moves will translate into higher energy prices for consumers, fuel climate change, and make the U.S. less competitive with other nations that are embracing renewable energy. Ham Energy Transfer Executive Chairman Kelsey Warren and Liberty Energy's then-CEO Chris Wright, now Trump's Energy Secretary, were some of the top oil executives who hosted fundraisers for Trump during the campaign. They wanted the next president to open up new markets by supporting new pipelines and terminals, to end subsidies for electric vehicles, and to kill tailpipe emissions regulations. Before the election, Warren told investors he was banking on finally completing Lake Charles LNG, a Gulf Coast terminal his company had sought to build for more than a decade. Warren donated more than $13 million to Trump's bid. After Trump became president, he lifted a pause former President Joe Biden had imposed on new LNG exports, and the Energy Department last month granted the project a permit extension that the previous administration had denied. Warren and his company each gave $12.5 million after the election to the Trump-aligned MAGA Inc. Super Political Action Committee. Trump's tax and spending legislation will end subsidies of up to $7,500 for purchasing or leasing an EV. It also brings a windfall to oil and gas and other companies in the form of expanded tax breaks. ConocoPhillips, CEO G Resources, Occidental Petroleum, and Devon Energy recently told investors that because of new tax provisions in Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill, they collectively expect to save more than $1.2 billion in tax payments in 2025, and likely billions more in the coming years. British giant BP, which operates in the U.S., said the tax savings would likely offset any pressure from tariffs. Although large producers such as Exxon and Occidental Petroleum have acknowledged that climate change is a major global problem, administration officials have said global warming is not a serious threat. In July, the Environmental Protection Agency said it aims to rescind a 2009 climate rule that states that greenhouse gases threaten public health and welfare by raising global temperatures. The agency has used the funding to regulate releases from power plants, motor vehicles, aircraft, landfills, and oil and gas activities. The Domestic Energy Producers Alliance, an industry lobbying group co-founded by HAM, praised the EPA's proposed revision of the rule, which the lobbying group called the foundation for nearly all environmental challenges facing U.S. oil and gas. Environmental groups have vowed to fight the move in court. Open doors. HAM and other top oil executives gathered on Inauguration Day on the roof of the Hay Adams Hotel overlooking the White House. As they watched the president deliver his speech, one of them called out, "He just said, drill, baby, drill." Others clapped and cheered. The industry had had rockier relations with the Biden White House. That administration had urged the industry to reduce emissions and embrace low-carbon technologies, and Biden had accused oil companies of war profiteering after Russia's invasion of Ukraine sent oil prices and corporate profits soaring. The joke among some oil CEOs back then was that their only way into the White House was through the basement. Trump first met with API and oil and gas executives in March at the White House. He told them it was his favorite industry and that there would be no tariffs on energy, according to people who attended. 2 weeks later, when Trump announced global tariffs on Liberation Day, oil and gas products were exempt. Since then, API has met with Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, Energy Secretary Wright, U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer, and other administration officials. At least a dozen oil executives, including HAM, Exxon's Woods, and former Hess CEO John Hess, have spoken to Trump by phone since the election, according to people in the industry. Many CEOs have Wright's phone numbers. "It has been a complete turnaround from our interactions with the Biden administration," said Mike Summers, who leads API. "We outlined a clear policy roadmap well before the last election, and they've advanced those issues at every turn." Most of the oil companies and executives named in this article did not respond to requests for comment. Early last year, HAM brought Wright, then still head of oil field services company Liberty Energy, to an energy roundtable at Mar-a-Lago. Then-candidate Trump went around the room asking questions. HAM later recalled at an energy conference that Trump was so impressed by Wright's answers that he asked Wright to lead out to DOE, referring to the Energy Department. Trump later attended a fundraiser at Wright's house in Montana, telling aides it was among the nicest he had ever seen. In April, after Wright became Energy Secretary, he attended a gathering in Oklahoma City arranged by HAM to discuss the need for more energy to support the rise of artificial intelligence. So too did Burgum, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin, and Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins. Attendees joked at how many officials from the administration showed up separately. Burgum, Wright, and Zeldin have been zipping around the country to visit fossil fuel production regions, talking up energy projects in Alaska, Louisiana, and Pennsylvania. ConocoPhillips has lobbied for years to be allowed to drill on new parcels of federal land in Alaska, where it is the largest oil producer. Biden approved Willow, the company's massive drilling project on the state's North Slope, but moved to restrict access to millions of acres of Arctic wilderness. On Inauguration Day, Trump signed an executive order to boost production in Alaska. At the White House meeting in March with oil and gas executives, ConocoPhillips CEO Ryan Lance discussed with the president drilling opportunities in the state, according to people familiar with the matter. In June, the Interior Department proposed rescinding Biden restrictions in an area in Alaska known as the National Petroleum Reserve. ConocoPhillips has since applied for federal permits to explore in the reserve, which is also where Willow is located. The announcements were met with despair by environmentalists who for years have fought to shut down fossil fuels exploration and production in the Arctic. A spokesman for ConocoPhillips said the company has been safely and reliably developing Alaska's energy resources for years, including in the National Petroleum Reserve, and that it appreciates the Trump administration's rule changes. While boosting prospects for the oil industry, the Trump administration also has taken steps to pause or halt wind and solar projects. The tax and spending bill ended tax credits, and the Interior Department issued an order last month that will likely make it more difficult to build solar and wind projects on federal land. Clean energy companies complain that the U.S. risks slowing the delivery of new power needed for the global AI race, ceding the China advances in solar panels, batteries, and electric vehicles. I think it's sad and bad for the U.S. economy, bad for competitiveness, and bad for the environment to be trying desperately to shore up the role of fossil fuels, said John Holdren, a former director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy in the Obama administration and now a Harvard University professor. During a fundraiser last fall in Midland, Texas, Trump repeated his campaign vow to drill, baby, drill, according to Curtis Leonard, one of the oil executives who attended. Someone in the crowd shot back that oil and gas producers decide whether or not to drill, not the government, Leonard recalled. Trade-offs. For years, U.S. shale oil companies burn cash to fuel growth but return little or no profits. Investors compelled them to rein in spending, and the publicly traded ones are wary of ramping up development even when oil and gas prices jump. Their inventories of premium wells have been shrinking. Trump has kept pushing for lower crude prices to help tame inflation and achieve his geopolitical goals. He has repeatedly told oil executives he wants oil under $40 a barrel, and executives have taken turns lobbying him against lower prices. He thinks lower oil prices solve every problem. It is a magic elixir, one oil executive said. A lot of executives had told him it will actually lead to bankruptcies in the industry and lower production over time. The recent tumble in crude prices has prompted producers to shed drilling rigs and crews that frack wells and added pressure on companies to do more with less. ConocoPhillips last week said it would cut up to a quarter of its workforce. Some of those layoffs were expected after it acquired rival Marathon Oil last year. Chevron announced earlier this year that it would shrink its workforce by up to 20%. The number of oil and gas extraction jobs declined by more than 3% between January and August to its lowest level in 2 years, according to preliminary data by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. In their March meeting with Trump, oil and gas executives lobbied for a carve-out for oil field products from his 25% tariffs on steel and aluminum, but that did not happen. Permian Basin driller Diamondback Energy reported last month that it expected some well construction costs to increase nearly 25% this year because of the tariffs, which Trump doubled in June. It said the duties would raise the break-even cost of nearly every well drilled in the U.S. this year. Still, many in the industry say Trump is bestowing so many gifts that a period of lower profits is probably worth the cost. "We all voted for this," said Taylor Sell, chief executive of Texas driller Element Petroleum. Next article. French government falls, prime minister is ousted. Dateline Paris. President Emmanuel Macron has lost his second government in less than a year, a measure of how France is caught in a spiral of political dysfunction that is draining its public finances. A no-confidence motion against the government of Prime Minister François Bayrou won the support of 364 lawmakers in the 577-seat National Assembly forcing him to tender his resignation. The fall of Bayrou, a centrist ally of Macron after less than 9 months in office, deepens the country's paralysis as investors question whether France can muster the political will to rein in its ballooning budget deficit. You have the power to overthrow the government, but you don't have the power to erase reality, Bayrou told lawmakers at the National Assembly moments before the vote, describing France's finances as a silent, underground, invisible, and unbearable hemorrhage. Whatever sense France has of a shared reality is melting away as Bayrou and like-minded centrists warn of financial Armageddon, while populist parties accuse the political establishment of using scare tactics to remain in power. All the while, France's debt continues to grow, reaching 114% of economic output, along with borrowing costs that outweigh what the country spends on defense. Macron's office said he would accept Bayrou's resignation on Tuesday and appoint a new prime minister tasked with forming a government in the coming days. The next prime minister will have to cajole lawmakers in the National Assembly, the highly fragmented lower house of parliament, to agree on next year's budget by the end of December. France is also facing a gauntlet of public protest against any cuts to public spending, starting with a Wednesday demonstration organized by the Let's Block Everything movement. The gridlock is fueling public frustration and providing anti-establishment parties with fodder to argue the time has come for voters to turn the page on decades of governments by mainstream leaders. We're witnessing the collapse of a system, far-right leader Marine Le Pen said on Monday, calling for new parliamentary elections. Lawmakers on the far left are demanding that Macron step down, something he has repeatedly said he will not do before his term ends in 2027. And Macron does not plan to call snap parliamentary elections, a maneuver that cost his party dozens of seats in 2024 and led to the lower house's current fragmentation. Far-left lawmaker Mathilde Panot called on protesters to take to the streets and pressure Macron to leave office ahead of schedule. The president does not wish to change policy, so we will change presidents, she said. Recent polls show new parliamentary elections would lead to another fractured National Assembly with no clear majority. The current parliament is broken into blocks with budget priorities that appear irreconcilable. Macron's pro-Europe forces, its centrist allies, and a group of conservatives have 210 seats and oppose tax increases. A rowdy group of left-wing parties, including the far-left France Unbowed, hold 192 seats and oppose any cuts to France's welfare state. Le Pen's party and its far-right allies have 138 votes. They want to cut funding to the European Union. The tripolarization of politics is making the country difficult to govern, said Benjamin Morel, a professor of public law at Paris-based Panthéon Sorbonne University. As long as we cannot overcome this political problem, we will only be applying band-aid solutions, he said. As the political crisis deepens, France's borrowing costs are rising, surpassing those of Greece and entering the territory of Italy. Fitch Ratings firm is expected to release a review of France's credit rating on Friday. For Macron, picking a new prime minister will be a challenge of its own. Bayrou is the fourth prime minister to lose his job over the past year and a half. Socialist lawmaker Boris Vallot said on Monday his party was ready to take the helm of a new government. It is now the left's turn to govern, Vallot said. We're ready, let him come and get us, he said, referring to Macron. But appointing a leftist prime minister means Macron would run the risk of seeing the new government reverse his recent increase in retirement age. Candidates from Macron's own camp include Defense Minister Sébastien Lecornu, Justice Minister Gérard Darmanin, and Finance Minister Éric Lombard, presidential aide said. But any prime minister from Macron's ranks would struggle to gather support from opposition parties that is crucial for passing a budget. Bahru called Monday's vote in an attempt to force Parliament to acknowledge the dire state of France's finances. France's public debt has gone from 2.2 trillion euros, equivalent to nearly $2.6 trillion, before Macron was elected, to 3.3 trillion euros this year. France's deficit reached a 5.8% of domestic output last year. Bayrou proposed 44 billion euros in budget cuts in an attempt to narrow France's deficit to 5.4%. That included plans to eliminate two public holidays. The moves ignited widespread political outrage. "We're not the ones overthrowing this government. It is this government that has decided to fall on its own accord," National Rally President Jordan Bardella said on Monday. The failure of France's political ranks to face up to fiscal reality is a déjà vu. Less than a year ago, the then Prime Minister Michel Barnier addressed the National Assembly moments before his ouster with a dire warning. "Listen to me, this reality is here to stay and it will not disappear by the magic of a motion of censure," Barnier said. Next article. Epstein birthday letter with Trump's signature revealed. Lawyers for Jeffrey Epstein's estate have given Congress a copy of the birthday book put together for the financier's 50th birthday, which includes a letter with President Trump's signature that he has said does not exist. On Monday, House Oversight Committee members confirmed that they received a copy of the birthday book, including the letter bearing Trump's signature and a second letter that references Trump with a crude joke about a woman from another Epstein associate. The Wall Street Journal in July reported on the book and the letter bearing Trump's name, which contained typewritten text framed by the outline of a naked woman. The letter concluded, "Happy birthday, and may every day be another wonderful secret." The signature was a squiggly Donald below the waist, mimicking pubic hair. Trump has denied writing the letter or drawing the picture, calling it a fake thing. He also filed a lawsuit against the Journal reporters, Journal publisher Dow Jones, parent company News Corp, and executives alleging defamation and saying the letter was non-existent. A Dow Jones spokeswoman said, "We have full confidence in the rigor and accuracy of our reporting." Carolyn Leavitt, White House press secretary, said in a social media post that Trump's legal team will continue to pursue its defamation case against the Journal. "As I have said all along, it is very clear President Trump did not draw his picture and he did not sign it," Leavitt said in a post on X. The Trump administration shifting statements about whether it would release the files it has on Epstein have hung over the White House for months. On September 3, Trump called efforts to make public more details about Epstein a politically driven hoax, just as some of the convicted sex offender victims visited Capitol Hill to tell their stories of sexual abuse and implored the president and Congress to release further records. Allies of Trump have long sought release of Epstein-related materials, but the Justice Department said in July that there is not a client list of people who participated in Epstein's trafficking of young girls, and new files would not be released. That determination triggered an uproar among some of Trump's prominent supporters and efforts in Congress to seek the records. Lawyers for the co-executors of Epstein's estate turned over a copy of the birthday book on Monday in response to a subpoena from Representative James Comer, Republican of Kentucky, the chair of the House Oversight Committee. In a July 25 letter to the Epstein estate lawyers, Representative Robert Garcia, Democrat of California, and Representative Ro Khanna, Democrat of California, had pressed the estate to release the book. President Trump called the Epstein investigation a hoax and claimed that his birthday note did not exist. "Now we know that Donald Trump was lying and is doing everything he can to cover up the truth," said Garcia, who is the committee's Democratic ranking member. "Enough of the games and lies. Release the full files now." In a social media post Monday, Comer accused Democrats of cherry-picking documents from the Epstein estate and said he was focused on running a thorough investigation. The birthday book given to Epstein in 2003 before his first arrest in 2006 was professionally bound and contained letters from dozens of Epstein's then-associates, including Trump, former President Bill Clinton, and billionaire Leon Black, the journal has reported. Some of the messages were anodyne birthday wishes, but others contained sexual references and suggestive drawings or photos. The Epstein estate also turned over another letter from the book that references Trump. It came from businessman and longtime Mar-a-Lago member Joel Paschal, who made a crude joke about a woman whom Epstein and Trump each courted in the 1990s, according to court testimony and people familiar with the matter. The Paschal letter included a photo of a poster board-sized check for $22,500, which had been mocked up to appear that it was sent from Trump to Epstein. Beneath it is a caption said, "Jeffrey showing early talents with money plus women sells fully depreciated with the woman's name to Donald Trump for $22,500. The woman's name is redacted in the image. The woman, a wealthy European then in her 20s, severed all ties with Epstein around 1997 and had no romantic relationship with either Epstein or Trump," her lawyer said. The lawyer added she does not know Paschal and has no knowledge of the letter naming her, which he called a disgusting and deeply disturbing hoax. Paschal and his attorney did not respond to requests for comment. The woman became a point of tension in Epstein and Trump's friendship, according to people who were close to Epstein. Epstein told these people that he believed the woman enjoyed spending time with him over Trump and that he was bitter when she ended up choosing to go out with Trump. Trump and Paschal were listed under the friend section in the book's table of contents, along with Clinton and about 20 other associates, the journal reported. Trump and Epstein socialized in the 1990s in Palm Beach, Florida. Trump flew on Epstein's private jet, flight logs show. Epstein was photographed multiple times at Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate. When Epstein was arrested a second time in 2019, Trump said he had not talked to Epstein in about 15 years. This summer, he told reporters he had a falling out with Epstein because his wealthy neighbor poached some employees from the Mar-a-Lago club. The Justice Department informed Trump in May that his name appeared several times in the government files related to Epstein, the journal reported. Many other high-profile figures also were named. Trump was told, "Being mentioned in the files is not an indication of wrongdoing." The White House called the story fake news. Next article, China hackers impersonated lawmakers. As the Trump administration's contentious trade talks with China were set to begin in Sweden last July, staffers on the House committee that focuses on U.S. competition with China began to get puzzling inquiries, according to people familiar with the matter. Several trade groups, law firms, and U.S. government agencies had all received an email appearing to be from the committee's chairman, Representative John Molinar, Republican of Michigan, asking for input on proposed sanctions with which the legislators were planning to target Beijing. "Your insights are essential," the email read, asking the group to review a draft of the legislation attached to the message. But why had the chairman sent the message from a non-government address? It turned out to be the latest in a series of alleged cyber espionage campaigns linked to Beijing, people familiar with the matter said. Time to potentially deploy spyware against organizations giving input on President Trump's trade negotiations. The FBI and the Capitol Police are investigating the Molinar emails, and cyber analysts trace the embedded malware to a hacker group known as APT-41, believed to be a contractor for Beijing's Ministry of State Security. U.S. and Chinese officials met in late July in Stockholm, days after the first email was sent. to pursue the type of high-stakes negotiations that spies in both countries were likely eager to obtain advantages in. The two countries soon after agreed to extend a tariff truce till early November, when Trump and Chinese leader Xi Jinping could meet at a summit. The hacking campaign appeared to be aimed at giving Chinese officials an inside look at the recommendations Trump was receiving from outside groups. It could not be determined whether the attackers had successfully breached any of the targets. An FBI spokeswoman declined to provide details but said the Bureau was aware of the incident and was working with our partners to identify and pursue those responsible. The Capitol Police declined to comment. Molinar said the effort was another example of China's offensive cyber operations designed to steal American strategy and leverage it. "We will not be intimidated," he said. Chinese officials have disputed U.S. hacking allegations, saying such claims are intended to distract from Washington's own aggressive actions. The Chinese embassy said the country opposes and combats cyber attacks, adding, "We also firmly oppose smearing others without solid evidence." The alleged campaign comes as U.S. law enforcement officials have been surprised by the prolific and creative nature of China's spying efforts. The FBI revealed last month that a Beijing-linked espionage campaign that hit U.S. telecom companies and swept up Trump phone calls actually targeted more than 80 countries and reached around the globe. China's potential use of Molinar as a lure was particularly galling for the committee staffers, given that the lawmaker has been a harsh critic of Beijing. China's leadership approaches the United States as an enemy to be harmed rather than as a partner, he said in January. The cybersecurity firm Mandiant determined the spyware would allow the hackers to burrow deep into the targeted organizations if any of the recipients had opened the purported draft legislation, according to documents reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. The Molinar impersonation comes as several administration officials have been facing imposters of their own. The State Department warned diplomats around the world in July that an imposter was using AI to imitate Secretary of State Marco Rubio's voice in messages sent to foreign officials. Federal authorities are also investigating an effort to impersonate White House Chief of Staff Susie Wiles, the Journal reported in May. The identities of both imposters remain unknown. The FBI issued a warning that month that malicious actors have impersonated senior U.S. officials targeting contacts with AI-generated voice messages and texts. Another alleged impersonation-based hacking attempt also targeted the China Committee. In January, staffers on the committee received emails falsely claiming to be from the CEO of Chinese crane manufacturing ZPMC, according to people familiar with the episode. Last year, Molinar's committee published a 50-page report alleging that Beijing could remotely seize control of ZPMC cranes at U.S. ports, allowing it to spy on American trade flow or disrupt the movement of goods. Next article, woman stabbing death becomes MAGA talking point. President Trump on Monday described the suspect in a fatal stabbing in North Carolina as evil and said the U.S. has to confront violent crime. A surveillance video showed the moments before and after Ukrainian refugee Irina Zarutska was stabbed in the neck on August 22 while aboard a commuter light rail in Charlotte, North Carolina. Zarutska, 23 years old, was wearing headphones and was focused on her phone when she was stabbed from behind. Police arrested the suspect, DeCarlos Brown Jr., 34, and charged him with first-degree murder. "There are evil people and we have to confront that," Trump said at the Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. on Monday. "We have to be able to handle that. If we don't handle that, we don't have a country," the president said. Conservative political figures, including Trump's Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, have shared footage of the deadly attack and used it to paint Democrats as soft on crime. Billionaire Elon Musk published several social media posts about the attack, calling for expedited death penalty sentences in cases with unequivocal guilt. Charlotte's Mayor Vi Lyles and North Carolina Governor Josh Stein are Democrats. On Monday, nearly 3 weeks after the fatal stabbing as it gained national attention, Lyles called for bipartisan legislation to stop repeat offenders who, she said, do not face consequences for their actions. What we know is this was a tragic failure by the courts and magistrates, she said. Our police officers arrest people only to have them quickly released. Governor Stein said he has asked for more funding for law enforcement recruitment in his latest budget. We need more cops on the beat to keep people safe, he said. Brown's criminal history dates to 2011 and includes felony convictions for armed robbery, larceny, and breaking and entering, court documents show. He was arrested as recently as January for misusing 9/11, but released after promising to attend a court hearing. A lawyer for Brown did not respond to a request for comment Monday. The White House has criticized judges in Democrat-run cities for releasing repeat offenders. Trump has made fighting crime in blue cities a cornerstone of his domestic policy. National Guard troops have already been deployed in Washington, D.C. to quell what Trump said was a crime emergency in the nation's capital. He has said he plans to do the same in Chicago and New Orleans. Next article, and we have about 5 or 6 minutes left. Gunman hits bus stop in Jerusalem, kills six. Attackers identified as Palestinians from West Bank were shot on the spot. Dateline Tel Aviv. Two gunmen opened fire and killed at least six people, including four rabbis, at a Jerusalem bus stop in what Israeli police described as an act of terrorism. Civilians on the scene and a soldier killed the gunman on the spot, police said, after the attack at around 10:15 a.m. local time at the Ramot Junction, a busy bus stop at the entrance to Jerusalem. At least 11 people were injured, including several seriously. The Israeli Shin Bet Security Service identified the gunmen as Palestinians aged 20 and 21 from the Israeli-occupied West Bank. Neither of the men had been previously arrested. A suspect from East Jerusalem was arrested in connection with the investigation, police said. The Israeli military said it had enforced a full closure in the area where the gunman came from. The military earlier said forces were encircling several areas in the outskirts of Ramallah in the West Bank in response to the attack, and that it was sending more troops there. We're now engaged in pursuit and are cordoning off the villages from which the murderers came, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said. We will apprehend whoever aided and dispatch them, and we will take even stronger steps. The Israeli civilians killed included five men and one woman who ranged in age from 25 to 79, according to the government, which said four of the men were rabbis. Ramot, near where the attack took place, is a largely Orthodox Jewish neighborhood in East Jerusalem, which Israel officially annexed in 1980, but which Palestinians consider to be the capital for their future state. A video showed crowds of mostly religious Jews fleeing the attack by running into clogged highways. Gunshots can be heard in the background. The military said one of the people who shot the gunman included a combat soldier from a new Orthodox unit in the military. Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad praised the attack. Both U.S.-designated terrorist group referred to the two gunmen as resistance fighters, but did not take responsibility for the assault. The Palestinian Authority, the semi-autonomous body that oversees areas of the West Bank, said it rejected and condemned any targeting of Palestinian or Israeli civilians, according to WAFA, the authority's information agency. In response to the assault, some right-wing Israeli lawmakers blamed the Palestinian Authority, which cooperates on security with Israel. Others called for revenge. The villages where the terrorists came from should look like Rafah and Beit Hanun, Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich wrote on X, referring to heavily destroyed sites in Gaza. And next article, which I'll only be able to read parts of, and it's entitled, China Keeps U.S. Foes as Distant Friends, Xi's Embrace of Putin and Kim Sent a Strong Message, But Alliances Are Elusive. Dateline Beijing. The pageantry of China, Xi Jinping, flanked by leaders of fellow nuclear powers Russia and North Korea, as intercontinental ballistic missiles rolled through flag-waving crowds on Tiananmen Square, marked a new phase in the redrawing of the international order. No longer circumspect about supporting his two rogue neighbors, Xi flaunted Beijing's growing links with Moscow and Pyongyang, both of them subjected to Western sanctions, both of them engaged in a bloody war against Ukraine, and both of them potentially useful to China in a possible conflict with the U.S. Despite becoming tighter, those relationships remain, for now at least, far short of an actual military or political alliance that could impose its will on the Eurasian landmass, the world's wealthiest and most populous region. China is very cautious about working with these two countries. Unlike what is depicted in the West as them being allies, China is not in the same camp. Its view of warfare and security issues is very different from theirs, said Tang Xiangyang, chair of the Department of International Relations at Tsinghua University, pointing out that Beijing has not fought a war for more than four decades. What China wants is stability on its borders. And with that, it looks like my time is up. This is David Ness. Thank you for so much for listening in to the radio reading service. And we just finished reading the front section of the Wall Street Journal edition for today, Tuesday, September 9. Everybody out there, have a nice day. Goodbye.